front pages. For the next hour, Chris will bring you the front page news from the morning newspapers. The latest headlines from around the state and around the rest of the world.
Hello, everybody. Today is Saturday, April 27th. I am Bill Murphy here with the front pages. I'll be reading from the New York Times and the Hartford Courant. We'll take a look at the pictures. The main picture on the front page of the Times is a picture of a gentleman. His name is Adam Abo Sharia, and he is consoling his wife, Ola, as they look through photos. It's hard to enjoy our life, she said. We feel guilty. And these people live in Springfield, New Jersey. I'm going to have that story first from the New York Times. The Current has two pictures. One I'll describe is students at UConn protesting the war in Gaza Thursday evening at the store's campus after police confiscated students' tents. Some reportedly slept out in the open, and you can see them sitting on chairs and tents and quite a crowd. That's a long story. I'm going to read as much of it as I can. That'll be my first story from The Current. And another couple of photos, very cute photos, a little girl named Iris Serralto. She's 4 years old, and she's sliding down the Wet and Wild Hill Slide during the annual Child and Family Development Resource Center Fun Mud Day at Eastern Connecticut State University on Friday. And she's having a lot of fun sliding down, big smile on her face. Underneath, there is a picture of Aviana Gildea. She's four. She's crawling in the mud obstacle with her mom, Sharon Gartwaite, and they're all muddy but having a great time. And then another picture, Mandy Shursack is sliding down the West and Wild Hill Slide with her twin sons, Easton and Colton. They're both 3 years old. She's sliding. Doesn't say anything about the mud, but right there, they're not muddy, but they're sliding down, and they're having a lot of fun, all big smiles on their faces. So those are the pictures, and we're going to start now with that first story from the Times that accompanies the picture that I just described. The call came in around 4 p.m. while Adam Abo Sharia was still at work in his pharmacy in New Jersey. The voice on the other end was sobbing. It took a few minutes for Adam to understand. His uncle's home in Gaza City had been hit by Israeli airstrikes. His parents and his brother's family were inside taking shelter after their own homes were bombed. Also struck nearby was a block of multifamily buildings in a neighborhood of Gaza City, home to many relatives and their families who were hunkered down together. It was the day before Thanksgiving, and Adam's pharmacy in Patterson was packed with customers, some of them picking up turkeys he was giving away. But Adam couldn't stay. After the call, he walked out in a daze, his mind swirling with questions. He got in his car and started driving nowhere in particular. While on the road, he picked up his phone, started calling his family in Gaza. His father didn't answer. Neither did his mother. He tried his brothers. Nothing. He tried every relative and friend. Over the next 8 hours, his frantic calls continued, but few details emerged. Soon it was midnight in New Jersey. The sun was just rising in Gaza. Reports were finally starting to come in. His family's Gaza home was flattened. The whole block was gone. Voices beneath the rubble cried for help, he was told, but there was no way to dig them out. Eventually, the voices fell silent. Adam's youngest brother, Ahmad, 37, the ambitious, energetic civil engineer, the children's favorite, who brought toys and fireworks, was found dead in the street. In the 6 months since the start of the war in Gaza, Adam and his wife, Ola, have suffered losses on a scale their friends and neighbors in New Jersey can scarcely imagine. In Adam's family alone, his surviving relatives have told him that 122 immediate and extended family members have been killed in Israeli airstrikes, he said in early April. One of Adam's cousins has compiled a list, a copy of which Adam keeps with him, of those who are gone. For some, The family has seen or recovered their bodies. Others have been missing so long, with many, if not all, believed to be buried under the rubble. They are presumed dead. The relatives lost span several generations of Adam's immense extended family, ranged and includes his 83-year-old father, his mother, one of his brothers, as well as aunts, uncles, cousins, and second cousins, along with their families and many children. The youngest killed, Adam said, was an 11-month-old granddaughter of one of Adam's cousins. Ola's surviving relatives, too, have told her that 70 of her extended relatives, family members, have been killed since October 7th, she said, in late March. Many questions about the killings may never be fully answered. It is unclear why the family's neighborhood was targeted during Israel's military campaigns in Gaza, and the Times could not independently confirm the majority of family members killed. The Israel military, when asked about the strikes, said it could not provide details without being given the coordinates of the attack, which was unavailable. It repeated its overall objective of dismantling Hamas while adding that it, this is a quote, takes feasible precautions to mitigate civilian harm, unquote. The Israeli government has come under sharp criticism from allies for civilian deaths in Gaza. But to Adam, larger questions about Israel and Hamas and the politics in Gaza only deflect from the deeply personal losses he has felt. I always say I am not a politician, he said. I am just here to tell you about our family suffering and how many people in my family have died, how many of them are still under the rubble. Many of Adam and Ola's surviving family members in Gaza, including Adam's brothers and their families, Ola's father, three sisters, and a brother, are displaced, hungry, injured, or battling disease. The luckiest relatives have managed to escape and squeeze into small apartments in Cairo. It's just agony, said Adam. And we are going to read another story from the New York Times. Lawyers for Donald J. Trump on Friday grilled the former publisher of the National Enquirer, causing doubt on his explanation for why he was suppressed. Why he did suppress salacious stories about the Republican presidential candidate before the 2016 election. The witness, David Pecker, who has known Mr. Trump for decades, faced a stern cross-examination from one of the former president's defense lawyers, Emil Bove, who pressed Mr. Becker about two deals he had reached in 2015 and 2016 with people who were seeking to sell stories about Mr. Trump. Mr. Bove sought to convince the jury of two fundamental points about the stories, which Mr. Pecker bought and then buried. Such arrangements, characterized by prosecutors as catch and kill, were standard for the publisher, and that Mr. Pecker had previously misled jurors about the details of the transactions. In one particularly tense moment, Mr. Bove pushed Mr. Becker to explain a seeming discrepancy between his testimony this week and notes from a 2018 interview with the FBI. Mr. Pecker testified that Mr. Trump had thanked him after the election for helping to conceal one such story, but the interview notes did not record Mr. Trump's expression of gratitude. Mr. Pecker, who ultimately acknowledged the inconsistency, resisted Mr. Bove's implication that there was a contradiction and said he had been honest in his testimony. I know what the truth is, Mr. Pecker said, suggesting FBI agents might have erred in their notes. I can't state why this is written this way. I know exactly what was said to me. Mr. Pecker's testimony was crucial for the Manhattan District Attorney's Office as prosecutors seek to show that Mr. Trump was part of a three-man conspiracy to bury negative stories as he worked to win the presidency. Prosecutors argue that Mr. Trump eventually falsified records to hide a third hush money deal in order to conceal the payment that his former fixer Michael D. Cohen had made to the porn star Stormy Daniels. The former president faces 34 felony charges and could spend 4 years in prison if convicted. He denies all charges. The prosecution witnesses who followed Mr. Pecker on Friday provided a less dramatic conclusion to the trial's first week of testimony. Rona Graff, Mr. Trump's former executive assistant and gatekeeper at Trump Tower, testified about entries from the Trump Organization computer system that contained contact information for Ms. McDougal in a, quote, stormy, end quote. The day's last witness was Gary Farrow, who was Mr. Cohen's banker when the former fixer executed financial transactions with the First Public Bank, Republic Bank, to enable the hush money payment to Ms. Daniels. Mr. Farrow will return to the witness stand on Monday. When court resumes, he's expected to take less time testifying than Mr. Pecker, who began his 4 days on the stand on Monday and said that he had come to an agreement with Mr. Trump and Mr. Cohen in a meeting at Trump Tower in August of 2015. And I'm going to read the story on the protests up at UConn. This is quite a long story. I'll read it until our weather break. It's a whole page long. I'll read as much as I can. It's on the front page of The Current. At a Gaza solidarity protest that lasted through Thursday night's freezing temperatures, University of Connecticut students were chanting Friday morning. By 9:30 a.m. on Friday, approximately 125 students and faculty filled the encampment, dubbed the U Commune, at Dove Tower, a part of campus situated between the Rec Center and Business School. Demonstrators shared coffee, donuts, and cold pizza donated to the encampment's overflowing snack table. Students alternated between strumming folk songs on guitars and playing hip-hop through an echoing speaker. Many gathered in groups to talk and create posters. Others joined in a yoga session. Roughly a dozen UConn Police Department officers monitored the area along the perimeter, and just before 10 a.m., organizers took up a bullhorn as news spread that a prospective student tour was passing by. Protesters chanted, "Free, free Palestine. There is only one solution. Intifada revolution. Disclose, divest. We will not stop. We will not rest. Resistance is justified when people are occupied. And every time Radenka lies, a neighborhood in Gaza dies." UConn students began the protest Thursday evening, calling for the university to divest from companies supporting the Israeli war against Hamas, according to a statement. The pattern of students setting up Gaza solidarity encampments followed by police intervention and arrests that began at Columbia University a week ago, has played out on campuses across the United States this week. At UConn, about 300 students gathered Thursday evening with one arrest, a 34-year-old graduate student, according to university spokesperson Stephanie Reitz. He was charged with interfering with an officer after allegedly pushing a police officer who was detaining another individual, Reitz said. Reitz said that contrary to some reports on social media, the gathering was largely peaceful with no reported injuries. The demonstrators were informed that their right to assemble and demonstrate peacefully would be respected, but that they would not be able to erect tents and or establish an encampment, she said in a statement. Still, the protesters slept out in the open after police took their tents, despite temperatures in the low 30s. In the morning, there were about 100 students gathered and several police at the site. The students, calling themselves UConn Divest Coalition, said the goal of the encampment is to protest UConn's complicity in the genocide of Palestinians in Gaza and its shameful contributions to militarism around the globe, and to advocate for a liberated Palestine. The group said they will not leave campus until UConn agrees to and enumerated a list of demands that the university disclose and divest from occupation and genocide, sever ties to the war industry, sever ties to the settler colonial state of Israel, and end repression of Palestinians and pro-Palestinian activities. E-Group points in particular to Raytheon Technologies, RTX, Lockheed Martin, General Dynamics, and calls for alumni trustee Brian Pollard, Associate General Counsel for RTX, to be removed from the Board of Trustees. While this encampment is unprecedented at UConn, our goal today is not solely to make history, but to end UConn's complicity in the genocide of our siblings in Gaza, UConn DeVest said in a statement. We center Gaza in our hearts and mind, declared encampment organizers in a communication to supporters. And we're going to stop now for the weather. We have the local forecast and the national. First, we'll start with the national forecast from the Times. Thunderstorms will bring torrential downpours, large hail, damaging wind gusts and tornadoes from northwestern Missouri to central Texas today. The highest risk will be from eastern Kansas to central Oklahoma and western Missouri. Hail and damaging winds will be the primary hazards from Iowa to parts of Michigan. Gusty winds, low humidity, and dry brush will result in a high fire threat for central and eastern New Mexico and west Texas. Showers and embedded thunderstorms are forecast to affect much of the central Rockies with snow at the highest elevations. The showers in the northwest may become steadier rain on the Washington and Oregon coasts. Showers will dampen much of New York and Pennsylvania. Warm air will move into much of the northeast on Sunday. And here's the local forecast for today through the middle of next week. Today it will be coming cloudy. A big warm-up is on the way. The high will be 65. On Sunday, a morning shower, otherwise rather cloudy. The high will be 69. Now here comes the heat. Monday morning, cloudy and warmer with a shower or two. The high will be 82 degrees. And on Tuesday, not quite as warm. A shower and thunderstorm in the p.m. The high will be 72. And on Wednesday, low clouds. The high will be 71 degrees. And we're going to go back to the front page of the Hartford Courant for the next two stories. Last fall, Litchfield High School cross country and track coach Brent Hawkins and boys soccer coach Rob Andrulis were both inducted into the Litchfield Athletic Hall of Fame. But neither one will likely be coaching this fall, at least not at the new high school in Litchfield. Due to low enrollment and as a cost-cutting measure, Litchfield High and Wamogo Regional High in Litchfield will be combining into one school this fall, Lakeview High School, which will be housed in the Wamogo High School building. The coaches at both schools had to reapply for their jobs. Hawkins, who has coached boys and girls cross-country, indoor and outdoor track at Litchfield for 31 years, and Andrulis, who has coached boys soccer for 23 years, went through an interview process. Both said they were informed this month they were not candidates moving forward. At a Region 20 Board of Education meeting on April 11th, a number of residents spoke up in support of the coaches, both of whom were blindsided by the news, and others familiar with the two coaches have questions. Hawkins, who is the former Litchfield Parks and Recreation Director, now works as a building substitute at Wamogo, said he had two interviews, one including a parent and some of his runners, and then another with Kyle Weaver, the Litchfield High Athletic Director, who will oversee Region 20 Athletics and the vice principal of the new school. I thought the interviews went pretty spectacular, said Hawkins, who is currently coaching outdoor track. But in a couple days, I get a call from the athletic director, Kyle Weaver, saying, thank you for coming in for the interviews. Thank you for the interest in the position. I'm like, he's reading a script. And he said, but we're pushing for another person. Goodbye. I was stunned. What just happened? I don't have a black mark on my record in 31 years. I restarted the indoor track program 30 years ago. I've been the head coach of boys and girls cross country for 31 years, indoor track head coach for 30, outdoor probably 25. It's just crazy what they're doing. Andrulis is a Litchfield High graduate who had a record of 234 wins, 140 losses, and 30 ties, the most wins of any boys soccer coach at Litchfield. He didn't want to comment at length, but said via text, I was told by the new AD at Region 20 that they would be moving in a different direction. When I had to apply, I sent in my resume that spans 40 years and three letters of recommendation, one from the current athletic director at Wamogo. I have decided to stay out of it and will be moving on. I'm proud of everything that my teams have accomplished over the years and certainly proud of every player I've had the privilege to coach. Time to climb a different mountain. Weaver referred questions to Litchfield Superintendent Christopher Leone. Leone said in a statement, the creation of a new regional school district has not occurred in our state in over 40 years. The blending of an existing town district with an existing regional district is unprecedented work. The process of staffing the new district involves over 300 employees with staffing, and in this case, coaches. It is an ongoing process that will ultimately culminate in the Board of Education action. Enfield Superintendent Christopher Drezik was the assistant superintendent when Enfield and Fermi High Schools combined with the first senior class graduating from a combined Enfield High in 2017. He didn't want to comment on the Litchfield situation, but said sports were the biggest flashpoint during the process. We got really lucky, Drezik said. We started the transition early, and we were building a new school, so it was a lengthy process. There was time for the community to get their heads around it, and staff. We knew the biggest thing was going to be sports. There was a handful of coaches who were disappointed but understanding. There was one that was a bit contentious, but it was kind of understood. The contention was more with parents than sports because there's only five starters in basketball and there's only one quarterback, one number one tennis player. That was more of a challenge. And we're going back to the front page of the Current. The Hartford Police Department is on a hiring spree. Its chief says will drive a budget increase, but attracting enough officers and recruits has been difficult. It really is about recruiting and retaining diverse police officers, Police Chief Jason Thody said at a recent budget presentation. In replenishing our ranks in the department to get back to a place where we can operate with lower overtime, less holdovers, and really operate the way we should operate with adequate staffing. The department, which is 108 officers short of full staffing, continues to suffer from low recruitment numbers. At present, the department has 378 sworn officers among its ranks. That number represents a loss of just one officer from the same time last year, showing an increase in officer retention. We have seen officer resignations slowing, yet officer hiring is just barely keeping up with the resignations to keep the staffing number steady in the 370s, Thody said. Challenges with hiring include low application rates and applicants not showing up for required portions of the hiring process. Thody, who announced last month he will be stepping down as police chief, is among those leaving the department this year. Thody was appointed chief in 2020. During the height of the pandemic and acknowledged several challenges during his tenure, including waves of violent crime and staffing shortages. As the city looks to hire a new police chief, the department also is looking to hire 50 new officers. Thody said the department is actively trying to fill slots for 25 new police recruits for this fall and an additional 25 recruits next year. But the police chief acknowledged that meeting those numbers will be difficult. To be honest, we're looking to fill as many slots as we can, Thody said during questions and answers at the budget hearing. As I go all the way back to 2016, we've never had a class of 25. Our goal is to hit that number, but the short answer is that it's an estimate and a wishful one. The starting salary for a new police officer in Hartford is listed at approximately $63,000, according to an application online. These staffing numbers affect our overtime budget, Thody said. We have 84 total shifts that we fill in a day-on-day shift, evening shift, and midnight shift. Of those, we're averaging 28. We have to fill through overtime, and six shifts per week have to be filled by either ordering an officer in or holding an officer in for a double shift because we just don't have the staff to fill those. Overtime pay for officers is often a large contributor to department expenses. In Hartford, $2.2 million, or 44% of the department's overtime budget, is driven by vacancies alone. Another 32% of the overtime budget is driven by concerts and sporting events, and the remaining $1.1 million, or 24%, is driven by special events like elections. But despite the department's high use of overtime pay, many officers in the city make the bulk of their annual salary from regular pay. Regular pay, as with others on the city's list of top earners, includes base salary, special duty pay, payouts, and anything else besides overtime. Hartford's top wage earner in 2023 made $266,751 in regular pay and just $2,889 in overtime. The department is also seeking to boost its diversity after years of scrutiny. And we are going to move on to the World and Nation section of the Current. This story from Washington. Before the Supreme Court heard arguments Thursday on former President Donald Trump's claim that he is immune from prosecution, his stance was widely seen as a brazen and cynical bid to delay his trial. The practical question in the case, it was thought, was not whether the court would rule against him, but whether it would act quickly enough to allow the trial to go forward before the 2024 election. Instead, members of the court's conservative majority treated Trump's assertion that he could not face charges that he tried to subvert the 2020 election as a weighty and difficult question. They did so, said Pamela Carlin, a law professor at Stanford University, by averting their eyes from Trump's conduct. What struck me most about the case was the relentless efforts by several of the justices on the conservative side not to focus on, consider, or even acknowledge the facts of the actual case in front of them, she said. They said as much as, "I'm not discussing the particular facts of this case," Justice Samuel Alito said, instead of positing an alternate reality in which a grant of immunity is required for the functioning of a stable democratic society, which is something that we all want. "Immunity is needed," he said, "to make sure the incumbent president has reason to leave office peacefully after losing an election." Alito explained, "If an incumbent who loses a very close, hotly contested election knows that a real possibility after leaving office is not that the president is going to be able to go off into a peaceful retirement, but that the president may be criminally prosecuted by a bitter political opponent, will that not lead us into a cycle that destabilizes the functioning of our country as a democracy?" Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson took a more straightforward approach. "If the potential for criminal liability is taken off the table, wouldn't there be a significant risk that future presidents would be emboldened to commit crimes with abandon while they were in office?" she asked. Supreme Court arguments are usually dignified and staid, weighted down by impenetrable jargon and focused on subtle shifts in legal doctrine. Thursday's argument was different. It featured some jaw-dropping moments, said Melissa Murray, a law professor at New York University. Michael Dorf, a law professor at Cornell University, said that the apparent lack of self-awareness on the part of some of the conservative justices was startling. He noted that Justice Alito worried about a hypothetical future president attempting to hold on to power in response to the risk of prosecution, while paying no attention to the actual former president who held on to power and now seeks to escape prosecution. "In the real world," Carlin said, "it's really hard to imagine a stable democratic society," to use Justice Alito's word, "where someone who did what Donald Trump is alleged to have done leading up to January 6th faces no criminal consequence for his acts." Indeed, she said, "if Donald Trump is a harbinger of presidents to come, and from now on presidents refuse to leave office and engage in efforts to undermine the democratic process, we've lost our democracy, regardless of what the Supreme Court decides." And I have one more story. From New York, President Joe Biden said Friday he is willing to debate his presumptive Republican opponent Donald Trump later this fall, his most definitive comment yet on the issue. Trump said he was ready, though he questioned Biden's willingness. Biden's comment came during an interview with the SiriusXM radio host Howard Stern, who asked him whether he would participate in debates against Trump. "I am somewhere. I don't know when," Biden said, "but I'm happy to debate him." So far, Biden's reelection campaign had declined to commit to participating in the debates, a hallmark of every general election president campaign since 1976. Biden himself had also been vague, saying in March that whether he debated Trump depends on his behavior. The two men debated twice during the 2020 general election, a campaign year constrained significantly by COVID-19 restrictions, and Biden was notably irritated by Trump's antics in the chaotic first debate that year. "Will you shut up?" Biden told Trump at one point during the first debate. Trump campaign officials have said for some time that the former president is prepared to debate Biden anytime, and Chris LaCivita, Trump campaign senior advisor, quickly responded to Biden's remarks on the social media site X, "Okay, let's set it up." Later Friday, Trump reacted to Biden's new public willingness to debate by saying everyone knows he doesn't really mean it, but suggested either next Monday evening, Tuesday evening, or Wednesday evening when Trump will be campaigning in Michigan. Trump did not participate in any of the GOP primary debates this cycle. The Commission on Presidential Debates has already announced the dates and locations for the three debates between the presidential candidates: September 16th in San Marcos, Texas, October 1st in Petersburg, Virginia, and October 9th in Salt Lake City. The lone vice presidential debate is scheduled for September 25th in Easton, Pennsylvania. And we're going to take a break, and then we'll be back with more Front Pages after that.
Located in beautiful Waterford, Connecticut, Oak Hills Camp Harkness is hiring for the summer. Our fully accessible camp is designed to meet the interests and needs of children and adults along the disability spectrum by providing activities that are creative, adventurous, and fun. We are looking for counselors, lifeguards, and team leaders, just to name a few. This opportunity is perfect for recent high school graduates or college students looking to make a difference this summer. Join Oak Hill for a summer you will always remember with individuals you will never forget. Oak Hill's Camp Harkness, empowering people with disabilities. To find out more, visit oakhillct.org.
This story from Beijing: U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken met Friday with Chinese President Xi Jinping and senior Chinese officials, stressing the importance of responsibly managing the differences between the United States and China as the two sides butted heads over a number of contentious bilateral, regional, and global issues. Talks between the two sides have increased in recent months, even as differences have grown. Blinken said he raised concerns with Xi about China's support for Russia and its invasion of Ukraine, as well as other issues including Taiwan and the South China Sea, human rights, and the production and export of synthetic opioid precursors. Blinken sounded a positive note on recent progress made in bilateral cooperation, including in military communications, countering narcotics, and artificial intelligence, on which the two sides agreed to start a dialogue on how to reduce risks from the rapidly emerging technology. But he stressed that even as we seek to deepen cooperation where our interests align, the United States is very clear-eyed about the challenges posed by China and about our competing visions for the future. America will always defend our core interests and values. Notably, he said he raised ongoing concerns about Beijing's supply of materials, including machine tools and microelectronics, to Moscow that President Vladimir Putin is using to boost Russia's defenses in its war in Ukraine. "Russia would struggle to sustain its assault on Ukraine without China's support," Blinken told reporters after his meeting with Xi. "Fueling Russia's defense industrial base not only threatens Ukrainian security, it threatens European security," he added. "As we've told China for some time, ensuring transatlantic security is a core U.S. interest. In our discussions today, I made clear that if China does not address this problem, we will." Blinken did not elaborate on how the U.S. would address the matter if China did not, but Washington has imposed large numbers of sanctions against Chinese firms for doing business with countries such as Russia, Iran, and North Korea. He said he urged China to use its influence to discourage Iran and its proxies from expanding the conflict in the Middle East and convince North Korea to end its dangerous behavior and engage in dialogue. Story from Washington: Secretary of State Anthony Blinken has determined that an Israeli army battalion committed grave human rights abuses against Palestinians in the West Bank before the war in Gaza. But he said in a letter to House Speaker Mike Johnson that he is postponing a decision on blocking aid to the unit to give Israel more time to right the wrongdoing. The undated letter, obtained Friday by the Associated Press, defers a decision on whether to impose a first-ever block on U.S. aid to an Israeli military unit over its treatment of Palestinians. Israeli leaders, anticipating the U.S. decision this week, have angrily protested any such aid restrictions. Blinken stressed that overall U.S. military support for Israel's defense against Hamas and other threats would not be affected by the State Department's eventual decision on the one unit. Johnson was instrumental in recently muscling through White House-backed legislation providing $26 billion in additional funds for Israel's defense and for relief of the growing humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza. The U.S. declaration concerns a single Israeli unit and its actions against Palestinian civilians in the West Bank before Israel's war with Hamas in Gaza began in October. While the unit is not identified in Blinken's letter, it is believed to be the Netzah Yehuda. The unit and some of its members have been linked to abuses of civilians in the Palestinian territory, including the death of a 78-year-old Palestinian-American man after his detention by the battalion's forces in 2022. The Israeli army announced in 2022 that the unit was being redeployed from the West Bank to the Golan Heights near the Syria and Lebanon borders. More recently, its soldiers were moved to Gaza to fight in the war against Hamas. Blinken said the Israeli government has so far not adequately addressed the abuses by the military unit, but the Israeli government has presented new information regarding the status of the unit, and we will engage on identifying a path to effective remediation for this unit, he wrote. From New York, Columbia University students who inspired pro-Palestinian demonstrations across the country said Friday that they have reached an impasse with administrators and intend to continue their encampment until their demands are met. The announcement, after 2 days of exhaustive negotiations, comes as Columbia's president faces harsh criticism from faculty. The development puts more pressure on university officials to find a resolution ahead of planned graduation ceremonies next month, a problem that campuses from California to Massachusetts are facing. As the death toll mounts in the war in Gaza and the humanitarian crisis worsens, protesters at universities across the country are demanding that schools cut financial ties to Israel and divest from companies they say are enabling the conflict. Some Jewish students say the protests have veered into anti-Semitism and made them afraid to set foot on campus, partly prompting calls for police intervention. After a tent encampment popped up Thursday at Indiana University Bloomington, police shoved into protesters and arrested 34. Hours later, at the University of Connecticut, police tore down tents and arrested one person. And at Ohio State University, police clashed with protesters just hours after they gathered Thursday evening. Those who refused to leave after warnings were arrested and charged with criminal trespass, university spokesman Benjamin Johnson said, citing rules barring overnight events. A preliminary report indicated that there were 36 arrests, 16 students, and 20 people unaffiliated with the university. The clock is ticking as May commencement ceremonies near, putting added pressure on schools to clear demonstrations. At Columbia, protesters defiantly erected a tent encampment where many are set to graduate in front of families in a few weeks. Columbia officials had said negotiations were showing progress as the school's self-imposed deadline of early Friday to reach an agreement on dismantling the encampment came and went. Student negotiators representing the Columbia encampment said that after meeting with administrators for 11 hours Thursday and another hour Friday, the university had not met their primary demand for divestment, although they had made progress on a push for more transparent financial disclosures. "We will not rest until Columbia divests," said Jonathan Ben Menachem, a fourth-year doctoral student. And we have a story from Washington. When President Joe Biden showed off his putting during a campaign stop at a public golf course in Michigan last month. The moment was captured on TikTok. Forced inside by a rainstorm, he competed with a 13-year-old hurley, H.J. Coleman IV, to make putts on a practice mat. The Coleman family posted video of the proceedings on the app, complete with Biden holding out a putt and the teen knocking his own shot home after the over the caption, "I had to sink the rebuttal." The network television cameras that normally follow the president were stuck outside. Biden signed legislation Wednesday that could ban TikTok in the U.S. while his campaign has embraced the platform and tried to work with influencers. The president, already struggling to maintain his previous support from younger voters, is facing criticism from some avid users of the app, which researchers have found is a primary news source for a third of Americans younger than 30. There's a core hypocrisy of the Biden administration supporting the TikTok ban while at the same time using TikTok for his campaign purposes, said Khalil Green, who has more than 650 followers and is known as on TikTok as Gen Z Historian. I think it illustrates that he and his people know the power and necessity of TikTok. The Biden campaign defends its approach and rejects the idea that White House policy is contradicting its political efforts. "We would be silly to write off any place where people are getting information about the president," said Rob Flaherty, who ran the White House's Office of Digital Strategy and now is deputy manager of Biden's reelection campaign. Flaherty said Biden's team forged relationships with TikTok influencers during the 2020 election and that the platform has only gotten more influential since then, growing as an internet search engine and driving narratives about the president. The Biden campaign says an increasingly fragmented modern media environment requires it to meet voters where they are, and TikTok is one of many such places where would-be supporters see its content, in addition to WhatsApp, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. It has produced its own TikTok content, but also relied on everyday users to interact with the president, and that includes a post from a family that ate fries and other fixings from the Cookout fast food chain when Biden recently visited Raleigh, North Carolina. And we are going to go to the Connecticut section for the rest of our stories. And we will start with this one. The State Department of Children and Families was notified about a domestic violence assault that allegedly involved two parents and occurred in front of their infant weeks before the man arrested died during a house fire in Wallingford, where the mother and child were found to have died before the blaze started. The arrest report was authored by the Wallingford Police Department following the March 25th arrest of 24-year-old Justin Venato, who was found suffering burns outside a house fire at 25 Geneva Avenue on April 17th. He was flown to an area hospital and was later pronounced dead. According to police, 19-year-old Karazama Johnson and the couple's 9-month-old child Kylen Varnado were found to have died prior to the fire. Police have said the investigation into the fire is criminal in nature. The cause of death for all three who were killed remain pending further studies, the Office of the Chief Medical Examiner said on Thursday. According to police, a protective order has barred Justin Varnado from being at his home after he was arrested on charges of second-degree breach of peace and risk of injury to a minor. The police report from that arrest indicates that a woman at the Geneva Avenue home alleged that Justin Varnado had struck her head in front of the couple's child, who was 8 months old at the time. The woman told authorities that the infant had not been struck and that she did not want Justin Varnado arrested, the report said. She said she and Justin Varnado had been living in Wallingford together for about 5 months and that the two had been seeing each other for about a year, the report said. The woman also told police Justin Vernado had been acting paranoid after allegedly smoking marijuana a few days prior, according to the report. Police wrote in the report that they notified the DCF about the assault allegedly took place in front of the child. It remains unclear whether the agency had an open case involving the family prior to the fire. The Department of Children and Families is collaborating with the Wellington Police Department and the Office of the Chief Medical Examiner to investigate the circumstances surrounding the untimely and tragic death of the nine-month-old baby in Wallingford, DCF Commissioner Jody Hill-Lilly said in a statement. This remains an active investigation, and no further information can be released at this time. The cause of the fire remains under investigation by the state fire marshal. Police said they are treating the incident as a suspicious death investigation. And we're going to take our final break and be back with the rest of the front pages after that.
The American School for the Deaf Online Academy is the first accessible online education platform for deaf and hard of hearing students, serving over 200 students from around the world. It offers core academic subjects for middle and high school students, tutoring, enrichment programs, and American Sign Language as a world language courses for public schools. The program recently expanded to also provide accessible support services, including speech therapy and counseling. This telecare program offers direct access to therapeutic services for deaf and hard of hearing school-aged children without the need for an interpreter or third party. To learn more, visit their website, asd-1817.org. The American School for the Deaf. Always able.
With less than 2 weeks until the close of the legislative session, House Republicans presented their own budget proposal that would add millions of dollars to education funding, but cut a program that provides free health care to children who lack legal immigration status. As House Democrats stand by their plan to leave the state budget untouched, Republicans presented the package of adjustments Thursday they say will balance the budget in fiscal year 2025. Representative Tammy Nuccio, a ranking member of the Appropriations Committee who crafted the proposal, said the Republican budget would boost spending on education-related items by nearly $300 million in fiscal year 25, including $80 million to fully fund special education excess costs. In addition to other budget initiatives, the proposal would eliminate the highway use tax, deposit $42 million in the teacher's retirement fund, and increase birth to three Medicaid reimbursement rates from $120 to $167 an hour. It would also add $3.6 million to fund early voting for municipalities. House Republican leader Vincent Candelora said the state's fiscal year 2025 budget is, quote, out of balance and $30 million over the spending cap, unquote. He said the Republicans' proposal would put the state $43 million under the spending cap without tapping into the state's reserve of Federal American Rescue Plan Act funds. We don't know if there's going to be a vehicle to run this budget, but we believe there's an obligation to run an adjusted budget, Candelora said. We need to first convince the other side of the aisle that putting your head in the sand and doing nothing and spending the last tranche of federal money that we have is not good fiscal policy, and it will only get us into trouble. In response to the Republicans' proposal, House Speaker Matt Ritter indicated Thursday that the state budget will remain closed and that Democrats will move forward with their plan to allocate ARPA funds in lieu of adjustments this session. Candelora said fiscal year 2025 requires cuts and that a failure to act would put the fiscal guardrails in jeopardy and our budget in jeopardy. We don't want to leave it in the hands of the governor. We believe we have an obligation as the legislature to put forth a balanced budget, Candelora said. It's a rare thing when an idea hatched in a lively pub over vacation still has its appeal come the unforgiving light of the next morning, and yet it does happen. Several years ago, Vernon Corral Artistic Director Aaron Brown was camping with his wife near Bar Harbor, Maine, when they came upon the engaging Irish music of the Jordan TW Trio from Manchester, New Hampshire. We go back and we go back again, Brown says, about the lure of the traditional Irish group led by fiddler Jordan Terrell Wysocki and booked for the month of August at an area Bar Harbor pub. Brown told his wife, Carla, he had to bring together this Irish group and the Vernon Corral, a 40-member Central and Eastern Connecticut community group that performs sacred and secular choral music dating from the Renaissance through contemporary times. Then he followed up with Terrell Wysocki and the others and made it all happen 6 years ago at a church in Vernon. It's not uncommon that someone from the audience will come up with an idea for a collaboration that they're excited for in the moment, the trio leader says, but it is rare that they will follow up when they get home. So I was thrilled when Aaron did that. Now, that collaboration is being renewed at 7:30 p.m. on Saturday, April 27th, at the United Congregational Church on the Green in Talon, Connecticut. The concert will feature music that goes from the ephemeral star of the county down with an indistinctive text but plenty of choral texture to the rousing tale of woe on the rocky road to Dublin and pub sing-along favorite Wild Rover. Terrell Wysocki, who calls himself very much a fiddler, not a violinist, says his two partners of 13 years, guitarist Matt Jensen and bassist Chris Noyes, can read each other's minds, and it's really impressive. Versed in music, theory, and having played together since high school, Jensen and Noyes are invaluable collaborators, especially with harmonies, he says. That's when I'm most grateful to have them in my band. Brown wanted to repeat the collaboration the next year, saying it was too good of a partnership, they were too good, too nice, and it was like lightning in a bottle. But a pandemic rudely interrupted. Artistically, I had been pulling my punches, Brown says, because there's only so much you can do with a choir that's masked without the normal nuance, blend, subtleties. After a period of rebuilding on the choir is back to, oh, this is what it's all about, says Brown, who has directed the group for two decades, has conducted the Hartford Symphony Chorale, and sings in the Hartford-based group Vos. That's V-O-C-E. It's not your grandmother's restaurant, but Blue Chip Indian Eats, an Indian-Mexican fusion restaurant that recently opened in Rocky Hill, doesn't have ornate decor or paintings depicting scenes of India on the walls. Unlike many Indian restaurants, there's also steak in the menu, and most of the food is super spicy, unless you want it that way. Or, I'm sorry, most of the food isn't super spicy unless you want it that way. The restaurant uses a Mexican grill model, think Chipotle, for serving its bowls and platters with rice and classic Indian dishes in masala sauces. There's even a Mexican taste twist with toppings offered of guacamole, corn, salsa, and sour cream. The owners call it Indian food Mexican style. Their fruits and vegetables are organic, locally soured when possible, and non-GMO, the owner said. The meats are ethically sourced and free of hormones and antibiotics, the owner said. Welcome to a modern-style Indian-Mexican fusion restaurant at 154 New Britain Avenue. The owner is believed to be the first of its kind in Connecticut. We're going to be serving food here that's the best of its kind, hence the name Blue Chip, said co-owner Krishna Sivansan. Or, as his business partner Priya Sagala puts it, if we don't want to eat it, we don't give it to the customers. Sivansan, 36, and Sagala, 32, are longtime friends who were raised in India and in 2015 separately came to the United States where they first met. The pair had a few other restaurants together before the pandemic, including a pizza restaurant, but said they have since sold them. Their latest business venture has been months in the planning, from the concept, taste testing, and menu creation. The pair will be hands-on in the kitchen, cooking their from-scratch dishes with timing that assures their dishes are always fresh, they said. And the menu includes pre-curated bowls or design your own, as well as platters offering one of three kinds of rice and two proteins. The pair has seen elsewhere how Mexican toppings can combine nicely with Indian food and decided to make it a part of their plan after Sagala tried it at home with good taste results. Samanson said they decided to call the restaurant Blue Chip because we're keeping the name as neutral as possible so they attract more than just an Indian crowd. The words are perfect because they denote the best, he said. The words Indian Eats is a tagline, they said. And I'm going to end with this story. There is nothing but love behind Gavin Anderson's big smile, and now the East Windsor community rallying around the 10-year-old and his family with an equal amount of love. The family is Kate and Colin Anderson and their three children, including Gavin and his twin brother Spencer and their 12-year-old sister Bailey. Gavin has spastic, quadriplegic, cerebral palsy, and is nonmobile and nonverbal, and the Andersons' home need major and very expensive renovations to make the house more comfortable for him, the family said. East Windsor's two firehouses, police department, and the town's EMS department learned of the need and have joined forces for Gavin's home makeover pasta dinner benefit to be held at the Warehouse Point Fire Department on Sunday at 89 Bridge Street. Among the renovations needed at the Anderson home are ramps on the front and back of the home so Gavin can easily and safely enter and exit the house, in addition to having more than one exit in case of an emergency, creating an ADA-compliant bathroom and installing a lift track system to move him from what will become his bedroom to the bathroom, creating a space in the kitchen for him to play and explore, as well as room to store Gavin's equipment, including a gait trainer for walking and his wheelchair. We've had three or four different quotes that are all over $100,000 to do everything we need, Kate Anderson said. The Andersons broke ground in September on the renovations, and they have been ongoing. Anderson said that even with donations, the family will still likely owe between $80,000 and $85,000. She's hoping all the work will be done by the end of the summer. Workers are customizing an island in the kitchen for Gavin to sit with his gait trainer or wheelchair to wash his hands at the sink or do arts and crafts. The current kitchen is being gutted and will become the bathroom, Anderson said. Doors are being widened and all the wood is coming out and being replaced with tile. The most expensive part is pulling down the ceiling to reinforce a lift to move Gavin from the bedroom to the bathroom so we don't have to carry him. The lift will be helpful as he gets bigger, she said. The lift is a game changer for us. We still have to do the front and back ramp, so he has multiple ways of getting into the house. Phase two of the improvements include making the house smart to sync him up with Alexa or Google Home. He will be able to interact and control his own environment, Anderson said. He can turn off or on the TV set or turn the lights on and off. Right now, he has to wait for one of us to do that. The lottery numbers for Friday, April 26, play 3-day, 208, WB8. Play 4-day, 0322, WB1. Thursday's late numbers, play 3-night, 115, WB8. Play 4-night, 6683, WB1. Cash 5, 1, 4, 14, 16, 29. Lucky for life, 3, 9, 21, 31, 41, LB8. Tuesday's estimated lotto jackpot, $2.4 million. Tonight's estimated Powerball jackpot, $149 million. And on this date, April 27th, 1521, Portuguese explorer Fernando Magellan was killed by natives in the Philippines. In 1810, Ludwig van Beethoven wrote one of his most famous piano compositions, the Bagatelle in A minor. In 1941, German forces occupied Athens during World War II. In 1992, Russia and 12 other former Soviet republics won entry into the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. In 1994, former President Richard M. Nixon was remembered at an outdoor funeral service attended by all five of his successors at the Nixon Presidential Library in Yorba Linda, California. And finally, in 2019, a gunman opened fire inside a synagogue near San Diego as worshipers celebrated the last day of Passover. John Ernest, a white supremacist, has been sentenced to federal and state life prison terms. And that's all there is today for the front pages for April 27th. I'm Bill Murphy. I've been reading from the New York Times and the Hartford Courant. Hope you enjoyed it. Get ready for the hot weather coming up early this week. And we will see you a little later this week. For now, so long.